coming to you loud and clear from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Carl Christensen, filling in again for Tom Clark. And as always, we're here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. And as usual, Zorba, we have some great topics to talk about today.
Yes, tattoos. Do you have a tattoo, Carl?
I do. Yes, I do.
You do have a tattoo. Do you know what was in that ink?
I have no idea what was in that ink.
No one regulates that ink. We're going to talk about that. Nobody. Not the FDA, not the CDC, not your mother, certainly, and certainly not your father. Nobody regulates that ink. We're going to talk about what those issues are. And racial disparities in treating pain, not just for adults, but also for children. Controversial, very important information that you're going to want to hear about.
All right. And what is our special recipe?
Chicken Mirabella. Now, in the New York Times, they call it chicken Marbella. But no one that I've ever talked to, and this is one of my favorite recipes from the Silver Palette Cookbook, no one has ever called it among my friends as Marbella. But you know, if you're a snooty New Yorker from the New York Times, you're going to pronounce it the
careful
right
now,
way.
Careful.
I have to be careful. But what can I say?
It sounds good.
What can I say? Oh, it's not good. It's awesome. It's been our favorite go-to recipe for more than 30 years.
800-462-7413 is the number to call, where you can leave a voicemail anytime with your question for Dr. Zorba. And stay tuned. You might just hear yourself on an upcoming episode of the show. That's 800-462-7413. And of course, later in the show, we'll hear from Chef Tom Clark in his enchanted kitchen for today's recipe segment. That's always fun.
Yes. Enchanted legendary kitchen.
Some now, enchanted kitchen.
What kind of a legend it is something else. And what sort of enchantment? Is it a bright enchantment or a dark enchantment? We've got many different enchantments.
All right. The Zorba Pastor On Your Health research and response team has been sifting and winnowing through the many voicemails listeners have left us. So let's kick things off now with a caller from Atlantic Beach, Florida.
My question is this. We watch the news every night and see ads for Prevagen, the memory. It's like a vitamin pill for your brain, helps with your memory. And so we looked it up, and it turns out it's made in part with jellyfish, I think, is what we read. And so I'm wondering if Dr. Zorba thinks that these things are quackery or if they really do help. All right. Thank you. Bye.
Quack. Quack, quack.
Oh, there it is.
That's the answer. That's the short answer. You know, we all want to improve our memory. And the fact is, as we get older, yes, our immediate memory is not as good. Yes, our ability to remember digits. Yes, certainly my ability to remember phone numbers is not there. Executive function, making decisions might be there, might even be better than it was when we were younger. But there's some things that we just don't do as well. And the fact is, that's a certain type of sort of normal aging. Unfortunately, there is no medication known that possibly improves a memory. We do know one thing. Exercise on a regular basis improves memory. We know that eating the right food, like a more Mediterranean diet, improves memory. And we do know that lots of people make money on pills to improve memory, and that improves their pocketbook.
And there's sleep too, right? We've been talking about
that's
that on
right.
The show recently, where sleep might be where memories are galvanized.
Well, you're right about that sleep. That you brought up a really good point. So it's not just how you exercise your body. It's how you actually get into a good night's sleep at night. Very, very good. How many hours of sleep do you get, Carl?
Not nearly enough. I would say five to six.
How can you survive on 5 to 6 hours?
I don't know. I don't remember anything. Who are you? Who am I talking to?
Next call.
I remember this because it's written down right in front of me. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413 is the number to call. Let's keep the voicemails rolling. Here's a caller from Missouri.
My question is, I need to go see the dentist. And it seems to me every dentist who want to x-ray, some of them want to x-ray the whole mouthful. Is it x-ray safe? Thank you.
Well, first of all, the x-rays are safe. A good dentist is going to do an x-ray. First thing I do is put a lead apron over you to make sure that the x-rays don't get to other parts of your body. You've had dental x-rays, haven't you, Carl?
Yeah, this is something that, this is definitely personal to me because I'm that dental patient who is always punting on x-rays. Like, I will always try to get to the next appointment and just keep opting out of x-rays just because, and I wanted to ask you this. Do you think, and I don't want you to be controversial here, if you don't have to answer this, if you don't want to.
Okay, wait a minute. I like
Are we over x-raying? Are dentists like over x-raying?
That is a very good question. So the idea behind it is we'll do an x-ray and see whether or not you've got a cavity that we can't see and we can't feel. Okay, good. It really is a good question. So what's the optimal amount of time? Because I, too, for many years punted with x-rays and I'd say, you know what? I'll do it the next visit. I don't want to do it at this visit. I don't think we know the ideal amount. We know some dentists want to do x-rays every single time you come in. You know, if you're coming in every 6 months, obviously that's the wrong thing to do. And some dentists say we want to do it once a year. Well, if you don't have any cavities and you have really good teeth and you've grown up with fluoride in your mouth from fluoridated water, the chances you're going to have a cavity are really pretty, pretty slim compared to others. So you'd have to go and look at the U.S. Public Service Task Force to see what their recommendation for x-rays are. I don't have it in front of me. As you know, folks, I do not have a computer in front of me. But the U.S. Public Service Task Force has weighed in. The CDC has weighed in. I do know one thing. We don't have an absolute number, but I think every 6 months is way too much. And for many people with good teeth, every year is way too much. And for other people, it may be every 2 to 4 years. And once again, depends on your dental history. I have cavities. I grew up without fluoride. And so my dental history, kind of a little different than yours. Now, do you have any cavities, Carl?
I am lucky enough to not have any cavities.
It isn't luck. It's fluoride. Fluoride is not luck. It was in the water. Fluoride got incorporated into your teeth, and so you don't have cavities. So, and you brush your teeth with fluoride-containing toothpaste. Not having cavities in your mouth, Carl, pays off as you get older because you're less likely to need caps. I have two caps in my mouth, and less likely to need dental implants.
800-462-7413 is the number to call anytime. Leave a message with a question for Dr. Zorba. And we're going to get back to those voicemails in just a bit. But first, Zorba, tattoos. Tattoos are more popular than ever. And according to some recent survey, 40% of Americans 18 to 34 have a tattoo. That was
Isn't that amazing?
Seems like a lot. Yeah.
That's amazing. I have to tell you, by the way, when I was in medical school, because tattoos were very uncommon in those days, anyone who had a tattoo, we did a syphilis test on.
Oh, wow.
And the reason was, it was felt that tattoos were associated, because tattoos can be spread by, syphilis rather, can be spread by needles in tattoos if they're not sterilized. And you automatically, somebody came into the hospital, you immediately did a syphilis test because you assumed they might have syphilis and not know it. Now, I just want to stand with the tattoo artists today absolutely know how to sterilize their needles. I'm not talking about all of them.
Yeah, I'm sure the overwhelming majority of shops are completely safe and following all the guidelines.
Oh, totally. Yeah. But what about the ink?
What is in the ink? Do we know?
That's right. Many of the inks are homemade. And the European Union has new rules, and they, in this particular article, calling into question pigment blue 15:13, whatever that is, and pigment green number 7, which said must be phased out over the next year. And it turns out these are really common major pigments. And the German Federal Risk Assessment said, no, we think that these pigments may have a risk of toxicity of the body. And the tattoo people are saying, no, if we want to use those pigments, we should be able to use these pigments because they affect the blues, the purples, the browns, and a lot of others. And you're talking about 60 or 70% of the tattoos that people get utilize these pigments. What should they do?
That's a good question. I'm guessing if you can't use green, there's not going to be a lot of Green Bay Packer tattoos in Europe.
The real difference is not going to be. The issue is, should this be regulated? Or should you have a sign up there and says, we don't know what these pigments are, just like we have a sign on cigarettes, and it says, the pigments are not regulated by the FDA. We don't know what's in them, and take your chances. Now, I am not for regulation. People want to get a tattoo. They want to use pigments. I'm not for that. But I'm for full disclosure, because the FDA is undoubtedly, if the EU is looking at it, they're going to look at it. I think it's for full disclosure. A little sign on that. Now, do you remember saccharin?
Sure. Sugar substitute.
Yeah. Well, did you ever look at the label for saccharin?
Probably not. Definitely not.
Saccharin, when I was a kid, was the sweetener. It wasn't very good. It made a kind of bitter taste. The FDA said, we're going to take it out of the off the market because it causes cancer in laboratory animals. And guess what many people did when they did that? They rebelled. They said, we want saccharin. We want saccharin. Because they just took off something called sodium cyclamate, which actually was rather toxic. And so the FDA reneged and said, okay, you can have saccharin. We're going to label it. Okay, I kind of like that idea. The FDA has not gotten rid of cigarettes. I don't think they should ever get rid of cigarettes because they'll just be bootleg cigarettes. They're not going to get rid of tobacco. I don't think they should because we'll bootleg tobacco. Regulate it, just like alcohol and other things. If you want to have a tattoo, you should know, maybe in a good way, who produced the ink. Is it made with what? And then what are the risks? And then you take your chances. Just like we get on a motorcycle, just like you're riding your car, just like you go on a ski trip. If I sign up for my ski pass, it says I have to sign off on the risks. I sign off on the risks. I think it should be risk enhancement with information. And I think the FDA should stand away and not regulate it. Because then we're going to have bootlegged tattoo ink. I mean, you know that. People are smarter than the FDA. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that. Oh, maybe I did.
They're not listening. That's all right. 800-462-7413 is the number to call anytime. Let's get back to those voicemails now.
You never know, Carl. You never know.
All right, back to the voicemails. Let's hear now from a caller who hails from the birthplace of Jane Wedlin of the 80s rock band The Go-Go's. Do you like the Go-Go's?
You know, Zorba? Carl, I have to tell you something. I'm a child of the 60s. I don't know the rock band. I don't know the music. I know a Go-Go because that was like disco and stuff like that. I have not the foggiest idea.
How about We Got the Beat? Have you heard We Got the Beat?
I have heard We Got the Beat.
There you go. You've heard the Go-Go's then.
That's right. But I'm not going to try to guess. Okay, I'll go Anchorage, Alaska.
No, this is actually in Wisconsin. This is an interesting fun fact.
Well,
this
that's
is
close. That's pretty close.
Yeah, you were right there. all right, let's hear from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin.
Hello. I am calling because I'm one of the 2.2 out of a million people that had an anaphylactic reaction to the Moderna vaccine. And I went through the process of filling out a VAERS, a various adverse event report, with the CDC and went to the FDA. And I also spoke with people at Moderna, and I'm working with my physician. My question for Dr. Pastor would be, where can I get information about if there are other people like me and what I should be doing? Because I still have no clue what caused it, and therefore what to do about it. And I've provided all the information to these sources, but I don't feel like I'm getting anything in return. I don't want to sow mistrust in any way, because I know I'm very rare. So that's my question. Thank you.
This is such a good question. So first of all, as she stated, she's one of the 2.2 per million. That's really, really important. Anaphylaxis, by the way, also occurs randomly. It actually occurs randomly. So I want to go back to the swine flu of Gerald Ford. You remember Gerald Ford?
Yeah, sure.
So what happened was the swine flu came in, and then we gave a bunch of immunizations. And then there was something called Guillain-Barré, which was, quote, the French polio. That was a nickname. And this was Guillain-Barré is caused by a variety of things, including viruses. For most, it's a temporary severe paralysis that resolves. And some people, it doesn't resolve, and you actually perish from it. And the FDA thought that this was from the swine flu immunization itself, because that's what it looked like. But then they kept track of how often it occurred over the next 10 years. They weren't giving this immunization. They gave different immunizations. And they discovered the risk of getting Guillain-Barré was actually greater with influenza than with the influenza vaccine. In other words, when you're dealing with these small numbers, they initially thought it was the vaccine, but it wasn't. It was simply coincidental with influenza or another virus. So here we have somebody, 2 out of a million, which is a really tiny number, who had anaphylaxis. And she would like more information. And the answer is, they don't have it yet because it's so rare. So they have to keep track of everyone who got it and then see if there's a pattern. If there's a pattern, then they might have an answer as to why she got anaphylaxis. And obviously, that's why you stay there. The anaphylaxis occurs in the first 15 minutes. But the other question is, did she get anaphylaxis from something else? Because anaphylaxis occurs more commonly than one in a million. In other words, anaphylaxis is not an uncommon thing to occur. It's much more common than with Moderna. So the long and the short answer is she has to keep track of that. Stay tuned with them because they may have an answer to this in the next year. And it's important to her because she has to know, was it the vaccine? Was it something in the vaccine? Or was it likely to be coincidental? And she also has to know that when she gets another vaccine, any vaccine she gets, if I got anaphylaxis and I was going to take a vaccine, I would stay in the doctor's office for a minimum of 30 minutes, but probably an hour. I would just make sure with any vaccine, because it might not be the vaccine. It might be the stabilizer. And once again, might be coincidental. We don't know.
Before the break, let's do that segment where a real life doctor takes on the mighty, mighty internet. This is Google Doc. All right. The following email came to us from Dave in Winona, Minnesota. Dave writes, on a recent show, you mentioned the benefits of intermittent fasting, and Carl said he practiced it by skipping breakfast and not eating in the morning. I also skip breakfast. It's the only way I can keep my weight down. However, new research done at Northwestern University, presented at the latest annual meeting of the Endocrine Society, suggests that skipping breakfast increases the risk of type 2 diabetes, regardless of whether time-restricted eating is used. This was a survey study with over 10,000 participants. Dave goes on, I'm now trying to restrict my eating after 6 p.m. and I eat breakfast. This is difficult since the evening has traditionally been my time to relax with a beer, crackers, and Wisconsin cheese. Thanks, I enjoy the show and never miss it. What do you say to Dave and Winona?
Well, I don't think you should have beer, crackers, and Wisconsin cheese in the morning. You can have Wisconsin cheese and crackers, but I think the beer would not be the right thing to have. You know, this breakfast issue goes back and forth.
Right.
You know, it was invented by Kellogg's in order to sell his cornflakes. We thought breakfast is the most important meal of the day. That's a slogan for the cereal makers, the most important meal of the day. The reality is we do know that people who eat food throughout the day generally weigh less than people who have one gigantic meal, you know, in the evening and then skip breakfast. And a lot of people skip breakfast, eat way too much at lunch. So I think there are individual differences. And I think you have to look at what works for you. If your weight is good by skipping breakfast, skip breakfast. Now, I don't have a weight problem. I don't eat breakfast. I don't really like breakfast that much, you know, unless I'm going to have a treat like a donut. My favorite breakfast treat is a donut, which I had this morning before the show. I limit myself to one or two a week. Otherwise, I'd have one every single morning.
What kind of donut was it, Zorba? I'm just curious.
You know, I get a plain old fashioned that I dip in coffee.
Oh, it's a classic. That's a classic. Yeah.
That's it. And I try other things, but they're too sweet or they've got too much stuff on it. And I think
there's something about an old fashioned glazed donut. I feel like if you're going to judge a donut maker, you use a level playing field. You just go with an old fashioned glaze. That's the way to go.
I got to tell you, I did that when I was out in Oakland. It was an old fashioned glaze. It was a special donut dealer in Piedmont, upper Montclair area of Piedmont. I went and got the donut, and you know what? It was pretty good. It met my standards. It's got to have a certain texture and a certain taste. Mm-hmm. Not too sweet. I'm going on about donuts, and this is a medical show.
I led you down that path.
I mean,
I can talk about donuts all day.
You know something? He should have coleslaw for breakfast. That's what he should have. Wisconsin cheese and crackers and coleslaw. Getting back to the question, you know what? Whatever works for you to keep your weight down is the good thing to do. We do know that many people who fast for 12 to 16 hours a day are overweight and eat way too much at night. And yes, you may reduce diabetes because you have breakfast in the morning, but it might be that people who ate breakfast in the morning actually ate fewer calories. It doesn't prove breakfast did it at all. It just meant that was a habit for people who did not present with diabetes. It doesn't prove it doesn't reduce your risk of diabetes. It just shows that people who are breakfast often are less likely to have diabetes. There's no cause and effect here.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Just post it on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org. And remember, Jell-O is also not healthy to have at breakfast.
All right, more of your calls to come. Zorba will be dropping in on gastronomical guru Tom Clark in his lovely kitchen for the recipe segment. And we'll hear from motivational speaker Matt Foley. Something to think about. All that coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX. Carl Christensen filling in for Tom Clark on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Now, look, we know you tune into the show to hear Zorba's healthy living advice, but you also show up with an empty stomach and an open mind to see what culinary wizard Tom Clark is cooking up in his unrivaled kitchen. So let's head over to Tom's kitchen where he and Zorba are working on a delicious recipe for chicken marbella.
Carl, thank you very much. Hi, Zorba.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. Are you ready for the recipe?
No, a little bit more. So first of all, it's chicken marbella. That's what I say. That's what my friend says. But I mean, if you look at the New York Times, you look at cookers, you know, people who cook, it's chicken marbella. Chicken marbella. It's M-A-R-B-E-L-L-A, you know. I mean, in the Midwest, we pronounce all the letters. We don't necessarily do it the Italian or the Spanish way, but it is a classic recipe from the Silver Palette Cookbook. I assume you've heard of the Silver Palette Cookbook, right, Tom?
Okay, if you say so.
It's exactly it. It was sort of on everyone's shelf back in the 80s. It's a classic cookbooks by two people, Sheila Luskins and Julie Russo. It goes well with noodles. It goes well with different kinds of pasta. It really goes well with rice, brown rice, white rice, or even Indian rice. It's wonderful because it's got a sauce that you're going to want to put on other things. And it really goes well with a delicious crunchy bread because, as I said, the sauce
Chicken marbella.
Marbella. See, you're pronouncing it the wrong way. I'm pronouncing it the right way. Marbella. That's okay. Exactly. Now, you like chicken, Tom, right?
I do.
Do you like olives?
No.
Do you like oregano, sort of Italian type things?
Yeah, that's fun. Yeah.
Do you like sugar, sweet things?
Chicken and sugar. What?
I've got to tell you, this has sweet, it's got vinegar in it, it's got a whole bunch of things. So anyone who has not made this recipe, you're going to want to try it, and you're going to want to try it with whatever chicken you want to. I usually use chicken thighs because I think they're the best, but boneless skinless chicken breast. Really, really
that would be chicken breast.
Chicken breast. See, you're a chicken breast person. That is exactly it. You can also just do it with two whole chickens. That's actually how we're going to do this recipe. You can use parts of it. Okay. Start out with a half cup of extra virgin olive oil.
Half a cup extra virgin olive oil.
A half cup of red wine vinegar.
Half cup red wine vinegar.
1 cup of pitted prunes.
A cup of pitted prunes.
A half cup of pitted Spanish green olives. Those are olives with a little red pimento in it.
Half a cup of pitted Spanish green olives.
Half a cup capers, and use the juice that are in the bottle of capers.
Half a cup capers.
6 bay leaves.
6 bay leaves.
A whole head of garlic, chopped up, peeled, or pureed. But you're going to use an entire head of garlic.
Okay, a head of garlic, peeled, and pureed.
A half cup of fresh oregano, preferred, chopped, or 1/4 cup of dried oregano.
Half a cup of fresh oregano, chopped, or a quarter cup of dried oregano.
Now, that's right.
Why do we want one or the other, or doesn't it matter?
Well, you'd rather use fresh oregano, but sometimes you don't have that in your house, and a lot of people have dried oregano in their house. A couple teaspoons of salt, kosher salt, would be preferred.
Two, a little tea salt.
Quarter teaspoon of ground pepper. If you like it with more pepper, just add more freshly ground pepper.
Quarter little tea, freshly ground pepper.
Two chickens, 3.5 to 4 pound chickens, cut up and quartered, or about 2 pounds, or rather 3 to 4 pounds of chicken thighs. In your case, it would be boneless, skinless chicken breast, or a chicken breast with the skin, any kind, but you need about 3.5 to 4 pounds of chicken in here.
3.5 to 4 pounds of chicken.
1 cup dry white wine.
1 cup dry white wine.
1 cup brown sugar.
Cup of brown sugar.
And 2 tablespoonfuls of parsley.
2 big tea parsley.
Let's make the recipe. In a large bowl, combine the olive oil, vinegar, prunes, olives, capers, and there a lot of the juice, bay leaves, garlic, oregano, salt, and pepper. So put that in a large bowl. Mm-hmm. Add all of the chicken pieces in to coat it and refrigerate it overnight. And you can do that in a bowl. You can do it in a Ziploc bag. I like the Ziploc bag because you can kind of put it up and down to make sure the juice is getting in. But it's got to go in overnight. It can go for a full 24 hours easily. Even 48 hours would work. But it can't just be for an hour or two. Mm-hmm. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Arrange the chicken in a single layer. Very important, a single layer, not one on top of another, in a shallow roasting pan. Spoon the marinade over it evenly. Then pour in the wine and then sprinkle the chicken with brown sugar. So bake it until basically the thigh temperature is the right thigh. I think it's 180, 185 degrees. I always look at it. And or if using chicken breasts, it's a little bit less. I think it's 170. Baste it 2 or 3 times with the pan juices. Why it's actually doing, when you're basting, do not brush off the sugar. You're basically putting that baste on top of it. Then transfer the chicken pieces to a warm serving platter. Top it with the prunes, olives, and capers that basically have been cooking in the pan. Place the roasting pan over medium heat and bring the pan juices to a boil. Reduce it to about 1/2 cup. Then put that over the chicken. You can strain it or not chicken, but you put it over the chicken. You're basically taking and reducing that over that and put that over the chicken. Now, this may seem like a lot of work because it actually
it is a lot of work.
That's right. But it tastes unbelievably good. And the real issue is, believe it or not, you can make it all the night before. And then you just put out the other things like the brown sugar and the white wine. You put it off to the side. So basically, you're taking the chicken, putting it in the pan, putting the juice on the side, shoving it in the oven. The day that you're actually cooking it is not a lot of work. The work is the day before. And that's why it's great for crepe. We have served 25 to 30 people with this. And whenever we do it, we actually make it once every couple of years. Everyone always goes, oh my God, where did you get that recipe? It is a fabulous, fabulous recipe.
Yeah, it sounds good to me, but making it is really, really difficult.
I think in your legendary kitchen, state of the art, you could do it even, I don't think you could do it in a microwave oven, but you could turn on your oven. You could turn on your regular oven. So, you know, I bet a lot of people have not written this recipe down. You got it.
Right.
Because they haven't written it down, you're not going to ask us to mail it into you, but you can come to our website, zorbapastor.org. That's zorbapastor.org. You can see pictures of Tom, pictures of me. That's zorbapastor.org, or of course, through Facebook.
Well, my work is done here, and it's been a tough 4 or 5 minutes.
Your work is never done, Tom. Never.
I'm taking a little nap, and Zorba, here comes Carl.
All right. Thanks, Tom. 800-462-7413 is the number to call anytime to leave a question for Dr. Zorba. Let's get back to those voicemails now. Here is a listener from right here in Wisconsin.
I'm calling to ask a question about pregnancy. We are going to be on our 4th C-section after this baby, and I have the option to have my tubes tied, but I've been reading things online that say there can be some hormonal impacts or long-term negative effects of this. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that procedure and if you think it's safe. Thanks.
I have a lot of thoughts on that procedure because we have four children. So I definitely have a lot of thoughts. So first of all, I don't think there is a hormonal problem. When the tubes are tied, the eggs are still produced by the ovary. They go down the tube, but they can't get all the way down the tube because the tube is tied. They go into the abdomen. The fallopian tube then sort of pushes it in through this little flappy thing. It then is going to go into the uterus, and it doesn't get into the uterus. So it has nothing to do with the ovaries, nothing to do with your hormones. However, there are issues with having your tubes tied. The issues are, is your baby healthy and going to survive at 1 year? That's a big issue. I don't find that a small issue. I find that a great big issue. So here it is. My wife, Penny, had four C-sections. And our last baby, Vanessa, was 4.5 years after Eli. And the question was, should we tie the tubes? And we were very happy, wonderfully happy to have Vanessa. And I thought, what if something happens? What if Penny ties her tubes? And then a week later, 2 weeks later, God forbid, as you would say, something happened to the baby and all of a sudden her tubes are tied. And we don't have a chance to have another baby. So I'm not for having your tubes tied right after you have the baby, unless you really want to do it. I'm more for waiting until that child is 1 year of age. And then I'm more for having the man to have a vasectomy, because you birthed the babies, you had the C-sections, let the guy stand up and let him get his tubes tied with a vasectomy. Why should you go through it? Let him go through it. It doesn't affect his hormones either. So my recommendation to you is wait a year before you actually have your tubes tied or your husband's.
800-462-7413. That's the number to call. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, we get so many calls from our wonderful listeners who have so many great questions for the show. And we also get some calls from helpful listeners who just want to share a comment or a health tip. So we made some time for those listeners in a segment we call Caller Comments.
This is a bunch of caller comments. People calling us with their health tips.
Thanks, we appreciate it.
Yes, we do. We do appreciate it. First up, Zorba, let's hear from a caller in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, hi. I was listening to the lady who had carpal tunnel and had trigger thumb. I, too, had trigger thumb and trigger fingers that completely, all of my fingers triggered, and I had surgery on two. And in the meantime, I happened to go to an acupuncturist who told me that I needed a gallbladder cleanse. And, of course, I sort of poo-pooed the idea, but I, not knowing anything about a gallbladder cleanse, that's what I decided to try. I had nothing to lose at this point because the surgeon told me I had 8 more surgeries to go because all my fingers triggered. And lo and behold, I did my gallbladder cleanse, not expecting anything. And of course, I'm visually impaired, so I couldn't see the actual results of the gallbladder cleanse. But not the first day after the gallbladder cleanse, but the next day, all of my fingers worked perfectly. And that's probably been 12 years ago. And I've never had trigger fingers again, but if I ever have pains in my hands, I do a gallbladder cleanse and you're as good as new. And according to the acupuncturist, your gallbladder controls your ligaments and your tendons. And I can honestly say it definitely worked for me. Thank you so much. I enjoy your show.
Well, you know, if it worked for you and it got rid of the trigger finger, because trigger finger is really where you've got swelling in the tendons and the ligaments and your finger kind of gets stuck. I've had trigger finger surgery because I had one in my left hand. I've got something called Dupuytren's contracture, a slight evidence of that. And the trigger finger actually helped me open up my hands carefully. If the gallbladder, quote, gallbladder cleanse worked with the acupuncturist, I love it. Maybe that's an answer. I don't know what they did. The gallbladder, it does not control the ligaments, the tendons, the muscles, or the nerves. It is just a repository for bile that is produced by the liver. That's all it is. On the other hand, whatever the acupuncture did to help you with your trigger fingers, it worked. It was a non-invasive way. Go for it. I'd like to hear from that acupuncturist to learn what they did, because maybe it will help other people. It would be great if you could do a cleanse that would actually help the arthritis in your fingers or your toes or in your arthritis that you have anywhere in your body. It would be a wonderful idea. And of course, we don't fully understand the pain with arthritis. What we do understand is that we don't understand it. And then we treat it with medications. And if the acupuncturist says another treatment that may work, let's study it.
800-462-7413. And finally, Zorba, let's hear another comment. This is a caller in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Dr. Zorba, for a man so well-educated and such a nimble mind, you crack us up so well. You were talking about that fasting, the two basically candy bars for breakfast and then a triple-sized dinner. And you said that does squat. Squat is not a adjective or a verb that you hear that often these days. So thank you. I appreciate your work. Bye-bye.
He loves the word squat, Zorba. So make a note. Use that word more often in the show.
It's not in Stedman's medical dictionary in that particular definition.
It's funny. I like the word squat. I actually like jack squat when you add
jack
to it.
Squat.
I love jack squat. And I tried to look that up in the dictionary.
And
rabbit hole. It was not jack squat was not in Webster's dictionary, but they did have diddly squat.
Really? Diddly squat was in the dictionary.
It was. It's slang for, quote, the least amount or anything at all, unquote.
Diddly squat is a word. Jack squat is not a word. And squat, like to squat down, of course, is a word.
Right. So, like I said, I went down this rabbit hole with jack squat.
I love it.
Ended up finding a bunch of SNL Chris Farley videos where he was the motivational speaker and where he's the best at delivering that phrase, jack squat. Do you remember that character? He was like this motivational speaker, the van down by the river. Yeah. Anyone who hasn't heard this, and if you want to hear Chris Farley, the great Chris Farley, say jack squat. It sounds like this.
Not going to amount to jack squat. You're going to end up eating a steady diet of government cheese and living in a van down by the river.
Any excuse to play Chris Farley on the show. All right, Zorba, humor me a little more here. You know me, I like to do little song mashups and little audio oddities. I like to make
I've heard that.
Little things for the show. I was trying to figure out a way, how could I get jack squat into a song? Especially Chris Farley sang jack squat into a song.
Sure.
And this right here is the best I could do.
Little ditty about jack squat. Two American kids growing up in the heartland.
All right. That was the best way I could get jack squat into a song. Thanks, John Mellencamp, or John Cougar Mellencamp now? I don't know.
I thought that was you, Carl.
No. I wish I could sing like John Cougar. 800-462-7413 is the number to call. More of your calls are coming up. We have another interesting topic to discuss. All coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX. Carl Christensen filling in for Tom Clark on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 is the number to call where you can anytime leave a voicemail for Zorba. And then stay tuned. You might just hear yourself on the show. But before we hear from more of our listeners, Zorba, can you talk about new research out that further shows the racial biases that exist in healthcare and more specifically with doctors treating pain?
Well, this is a very important article. It's an article, actually, it was a review published in the Washington Post. Look at doctors, healthcare workers. And of course, we now realize that systemic racism is an issue. It's pervasive. In other words, we may think one thing and we may do something else. And this is actually an article that had to do with studying surgery. So this is a national study. Included almost 1 million emergency room patients. Okay. These are patients who actually had an acute appendicitis or another acute injury, but most of them were acute appendicitis. They looked at Black children and white children in the emergency room, and the Black children were one-fifth as likely to receive opioid painkillers in the emergency room as white children. In other words, they only about, we'll say in terms of that, 20% as likely to actually receive opioid painkillers in the emergency room. In other words, so the white kids' pain was perceived as greater than the black kids' pain, or the black kids were perceived to be able to tolerate pain better than the white kids. And it turns out when you look at adults that come to the emergency room, it's really the same thing. And the question is, what do we do about it? I mean, if we actually have it there, how do we do that? How do we relate to people of a different culture? You're a white person, you're treating a black person or someone of color. How do you then evaluate their pain? That's an important question. And then what do we think about this in terms of empathy? What would you, if you were to try to adapt a system to try to do this, what would you think would be a good idea, Carl? Just off the bat, what do you think?
I got to say, when I read the article, I was pretty stunned by those statistics.
Stunning. I have no idea
the solution to this, but I think a good start is people knowing about it, I guess. You know, that's why we talk about it on the show.
You know what? That's exactly what we do with medical students. And that's exactly what we have to do with healthcare professionals. It's a matter of education. It's a matter of recognizing, hey, we have to do it. Sometimes the way to do it is to have two people looking at the person in pain. And then they come to a conclusion, because one person may have one view, one person may have another view, and that may be a way to do it. It might just be like the monitoring of pain, an acute abdomen in an emergency room, make a difference. Nonetheless, the real issue is this is a real thing. It even affects us in medical care. And we physicians and other healthcare professionals have to be aware of it in order to root it out and come up with an answer, because we should be treating everyone equally, regardless of color.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. That's the number to call anytime and leave a voicemail for Dr. Zorba. Let's get back to those voicemails. Here's one from a caller in Norman, Oklahoma.
Hi, I just had a technical question about the U.S. health system. As a foreign-born immigrant to the United States, can you please, Dr. Zorba, can you please explain me the mid-level service provider systems in the United States, the need for nurse practitioners and PAs and not real doctors? Could you please explain me that? Because I don't understand why are they allowed to practice, and when the doctors have to go so much practice, such a hard work to go through medical schools, these people with 2 or 3 years tops can prescribe medicine. Thank you.
Well, the mid-level providers can be really quite good. The nurse practitioners and the PAs can do a dynamite job, you're right, with less training. And I'll tell you why that's actually become even more common as life has gone on. So back when I was in medical school, you know, you had a good clinician could tell whether or not you had an acute abdomen with gallbladder disease. And there was something called Cope's Evaluation of the Acute Abdomen. I think that was the name of the book. And there was another one, DeGowan, that actually talked about how careful you had to be in terms of looking at an acute abdomen and deciding whether or not to open it up. Okay, now you have the introduction of ultrasound in the 80s, and ultrasound helped tremendously. So you didn't have to have those clinical diagnostic skills. Then you had, in the late 80s and in the 90s, the introduction of the CAT scan. Then you had the CAT scan, the ultrasound, and the MRI scan. So in other words, mid-level providers do a very, very good job, because they now can order technology that replaces lots of things that medical students were taught how to do and how to evaluate. And that's why mid-level providers and PAs have made a difference. Now, the real difference is that we basically train too many specialty doctors. We should be training half our workforce to be in primary care, and the other half should be in specialty, or maybe 60% in primary care. And the reality is, you come out of medical school with $250,000 or $300,000 in debt. You got to pay off the debt. It's harder to pay off in debt if you're a family doc or an internist or a pediatrician. Easier if you are a surgeon or a neurosurgeon or an ophthalmologist. And if the federal government, in their infinite wisdom, was to say, hey, you go into primary care for 10 years, we're going to help you pay off that debt, they would have a lot more doctors going into primary care. And frankly, that would improve our medical system.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. All right, Zorba, I hope you remembered to pick up your black robe from the dry cleaners. Did you remember?
I did.
Okay,
I did.
Good. Perfect. Good. Time again to do the segment we call Judge Zorba. All right, Zorba, this case comes from an anonymous listener who writes, "Hello, Dr. Zorba, longtime listener. This show is like having an old, wise friend come spend a little time with me. It's so comforting." That's a pretty nice start, isn't it?
You bet. You bet.
All right. They go on. "My husband is keeping me up most nights now. If he isn't snoring, he is loudly mouth breathing. Are there solutions we can explore to remedy this? My best thought on this is to go to sleep in another room so I can get a full night's sleep. Thanks for your advice you can give. Sincerely, Sleepless in Wisconsin."
Actually, that going into another room as you get older and older is actually not uncommon, especially because one person may be on a CPAP machine for their sleep apnea and the other one can't get to sleep with it. The breathe right strips actually do help some people open up their nose so they can breathe better. A certain nasal sprays, fluticasone nasal spray can help. There are antihistamine nasal sprays to open up. Sometimes you have polyps in the nose and basically removing the polyps by a surgeon with a snare. But if he's a mouth breather, opening up his nasal passages in some way may actually make a difference. And short of that, you just have to get used to it. And if you can't, well, what can I say? What can I say?
So they signed it, like I said, Sleepless in Wisconsin. It reminded me of something. And, you know, we were talking about tattoos earlier. I have a very hot tip here for a unique business opportunity for somebody living
hot
in
tip.
Seattle.
Hot
yeah,
tip.
Hot
okay.
tip here. You
hot
ready
tip.
For a hot,
hot
tip?
Tip? Yeah,
okay.
I am.
And you know someone who lives in Seattle, right?
My two daughters live
That's
in Seattle.
That's what I thought.
I've got two, and their families. I've got two friends that live in Seattle. Yeah, Seattle's one of the places I go to.
Yeah, maybe you can pass this business opportunity off to them. So, you know, when you get all your arms full of tattoos, that's called a sleeve, right? You've heard
yes,
of that,
yes,
a full
yes.
sleeve.
Right, yes.
Okay, I was thinking, how about a tattoo removal company mm-hmm. called Sleeveless in Seattle?
Oh, God.
Think that would work?
You know what? All I can say is you buy the domain and see if anyone bites.
That's a great idea. There you go. All right. Do you need Judge Zorba to make a ruling that just might save your marriage? Don't sleep on it. Just post your question on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
All right. 800-462-7413 is the number to call. Let's hear now from a caller who hails from the birthplace of Milwaukee Brewers manager Craig Counsell, as well as famous musicologist Michael Galope. This is a caller in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin.
My question for Dr. Zorba is, I have an eye infection that my doctor's treating with triple antibiotic eye drops. It hasn't gone away, so now he wants me to take an oral antibiotic, doxycycline. And I'm just wondering if that's necessary for an eye infection. Is that what you would do if the drops aren't working, if Dr. Zorba would know that? Thank you.
You know, there are a couple of issues with eye infections. A lot of eye infections are viral. They're not bacterial. So a lot of eye infections can be treated by washing the eyelid to get that sort of crusty stuff off the eyelid. And the way you do that is you take some water and you take some Johnson's Baby Shampoo, just a few drops in there, so you can actually do it, the No More Tears Shampoo, and wash your eyelids once or twice a day to get that, to basically get the crust off of it. And then buy a microwavable eye mask. You can buy them on the web or you can buy them in any drugstore. Put it in the microwave to warm it up. And what you do is you just take a lubricating eye drop. You put a drop in your eye, put the eye mask on for 5 minutes, and you do that twice a day and see if that works. So that's a non-pharmacological way to treat it, because quite often they're really not bacterial infections. They're viral infections, and you just have inflammation there. Short of that, I would do a second eye drop instead of the first eye drop. In other words, there are other eye drops in other classes, such as a ciprofloxacin, a different antibiotic eye drop. I would do a second eye drop before I would go to an oral antibiotic. But the first thing I would do is just get rid of the crud in your eye that often is present even if you don't see it, so your eye can go back to its natural state.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And before we head out today, Zorba, we'd love when our listeners chime in and drop some knowledge or lend their expertise to the show. The following listener tip came from John in Green Lake, Wisconsin. John writes, "Dear Zorba and Tom, on a recent show, Tom read a letter from a listener concerned about a certain sound near the end of your theme song. I believe the listener's concern has to do with the sound of a particular percussion instrument known as a vibraslap.
Oh.
The vibraslap produces a rattling sound when played. It has a wooden ball at one end, a metal stem that loops around so it terminates below said ball at a small open wooden-ended box that has loose metal teeth inside.
You know, this is way too complex for my simple brain to follow.
This sounds like a band director. I like this. This is a good description of this percussion instrument. Striking the ball sends vibrations down the stem to the box, making the teeth rattle to produce that irritating sound. John goes on, being in my 40th year of being a public school band director.
There we go.
I've had a few opportunities to have students use vibraslaps, just as long as they don't vibra-slap each other. One of the most well-known compositions deploying the vibra-slap in its opening is Ozzy Osbourne's Crazy Train. Have you heard the song Crazy Train? I know you have. If you've been to a sporting event, you've heard Crazy Train.
Yeah, I would have to, you know, I would probably know what it sounds like.
And if you haven't heard it, Brad, can you play a little bit of Crazy Train for us?
Yes.
There it is.
Yes. Oh, is that it?
That's the vibra-slap right there.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's, you know, Randy Rhoads.
Gets the crowd going. I don't know if it gets the public radio crowd going, but it definitely gets the crowd going.
You never know. I mean,
sporting events.
It could. Anyways, John goes on. The vibra-slap was made to imitate the sound of an animal's, which is usually a donkey's, jawbone. Ancient peoples who would make music with what was available would occasionally save a jawbone until the teeth would loosen.
Oh.
At that point, it could be struck and produce that rattling sound.
Huh.
I'm sure the great Ben Sidran and his son Leo had their musical reasons for including this sound effect in your theme music. I'm certain they were making no subliminal references to either Zorba or Tom having jaw-jarring personalities.
No, I agree with you. That's
hope this
right.
helps. Have a wonderful
you.
Show. That's a great email, John. Thanks a lot.
It's a great email. And you know what? Thank you very much, because they did the theme song for the show that we still use and love.
It holds up. It's how many years now? Over 25 years. We're still
using
that theme song.
Over 25 years old. That's right. And it holds up. You got it. Yeah, you know something? It's a classic.
It's a stone cold classic. All right. Do you think the hosts need to bone up on their percussion expertise? Hit us up by posting on our Facebook page or by sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stay well, Zorba.
Stay well, Carl.
All right. If you missed anything during the show, or you just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or, of course, through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime to leave your question at 800-462-7413. And please do visit the Zorba Pastor On Your Health Facebook page for Zorba's frequent coronavirus updates. Zorba Pastor On Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is me, Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor and Tom Clark, I'm Carl Christensen, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor On Your Health.
Did you miss something on today's show? Simply go to ZorbaPastor.org to catch up on all things Zorba. There you will find recipes from the show, links to the Facebook page, Zorba's Healthy Living articles, and you can subscribe to the weekly podcast. On the web, that's ZorbaPastor.org.